The following program is a commentary program. The views and opinions expressed on this program are those of Dale Jackson, his guests, and callers. They do not represent the views of Cumulus Broadcasting, its management, or this station. At Athens State University on the Dale Jackson Show. News Talk 770 AM, 92.5 FM, WVNN.
WVNN, did you forget to turn my microphone on?
Yeah, this news setup. I I've been doing good.
All right, we got a new microphone set up in here. It sounds a little bit better, even though you can't tell. All right, News Talk, 770 AM, 92.5 FM, WVNN News Time, 8:07 here on your Thursday morning. You know what that means? It means it's time to talk to Dr. Jess Brown, Athens State University. He joins us right now to talk about a bunch of things, so let's get to it. Dr. Brown, good morning. How are you doing?
Good morning, Dale. How are you?
I know your allergies are bothering you, huh?
Yeah, not as bad. Not as bad this week, but I'll tell you, I hate to wish anybody bad luck with all this marvelous weather, but I could stomach a hard rain or something.
Yeah.
The pollen is just wicked.
Well, I hope it doesn't happen tonight at Congressman Mo Brooks' birthday party that's happening.
That's
down.
True. Happy birthday, Congressman.
Let's talk about one of the things he was referencing. He was talking about voter fraud there for a second, and he rattled off some stuff that was pretty interesting. Do you you heard what he had to say about voter fraud? You heard his take on the issue. I've ran into a bunch of people who have basically said, I wrote a piece for AL.com. Everyone basically said, no, there's no such thing as voter fraud. This is a farce. Roland Martin from TV1 and Radio 1, formerly of CNN. Oh, voter fraud's not a real thing. That seems to be the canned response, which, I mean, I guess if you could say that's not a real thing and then just shut down the conversation, that's a pretty good one. But what do you think about it when Mo Brooks lays out all those instances of voter fraud that he can think of just personally? Do we need a more effective messenger on the issue of voter fraud?
Well, I'm not going to say we need a more effective messenger, but we need to avoid buying into either one of two extremes. One extreme is that there's no voter fraud. That's nuts. We have almost every election cycle, different places in the United States, examples of misbehavior. And misbehavior by folks trying to rig the outcome of elections. So we do have voter fraud. But we shouldn't buy into the other extreme either, and that is that I personally do not believe that it is so pervasive that it completely undermines the legitimacy of most of the people who hold elective office. I think most of your officials out there were, in effect, elected by a process where the votes were properly counted. While Congressman Brooks did a very good job of ticking off several examples that had occurred in his lengthy career in politics in this very region, it should also be pointed out that we've also had in recent years, since we've gone to scantrons and electronic voting, we've had some recounts in states because states have now adopted these recounts, and it's amazing how when we do these recounts, where we actually match up actual ballots to the electronic count. So we're getting pretty, we're getting pretty accurate. We find a 12-vote difference or an 8-vote difference or whatever. And so I just don't want anybody to believe that voter fraud and the level of corruption is so widespread that most of your officials running around out there are products of fraudulent elections. I don't think it's there. But now you won't get an argument out of me on voter ID. I think we ought to have strict voter registration guidelines, and we ought to have photo IDs, and it ought to be required. I believe I would even go so far. I'd like to see Alabama at least investigate the possibility of just doing away with absentee ballots. because they have that's a real problem.
I agree with
that's a problem waiting to happen. But the trade-off there is we ought to have multi-day voting.
Sure.
Yeah, multi-day voting and do away with absentee ballots.
Have early voting, away with absentee ballots on election day. You count the votes and you're done.
That's right. I sense that we have recently discovered in Alabama, I believe there are four counties, primarily in the Alabama Black Belt, where we're back to a situation that we had, frankly, in the 1970s, where we apparently now have the Census Bureau has a count for the number of adults in the county, and apparently we have more people on the voter registration rolls than the Census Bureau says there are adults living in the county. Now that's a bit difficult to swallow.
Yeah, it seems a bit laughable that would be going on, and then any attempt to change that is met with the idea that it's just a complete assault on voting rights to ask for accountability on something. It just to me seems crazy.
I think legitimacy of the electoral process is so important. I would even go so far as to require periodic re-registration. But now politically, you can't pull that off. Politically, the rank and file voter just goes bonkers. You know, to have a driver's license, don't you have to go down every 5 years or so and kind of indicate who you are and you're back and you've got a pulse and, you know, you get your license re-up. I think I would put us all on sort of a rotational basis based on the alphabet. And about every 5 or 6 years, all of us would have to go down and re-register. Dale Jackson, every 5 years, the J's would come up and the B's would come up for me and so forth, and we would have to go down and re-register. And I think the re-registration process would, coupled with the absentee, if you'll reform the absentee ballot process and perhaps just abolish them, that would go a long, long way, I think, to cleaning up the kind of problems I've seen here in Alabama over the years.
Now, why do people react so adamantly against any opportunity or any attempts to deal with the issue of voter fraud? I mean, is it as simple as I put it? Republicans want to attack voter fraud because they feel it benefits Democrats, and Democrats don't want to deal with voter fraud for the exact same reason. I mean, is that fair?
Part of it's just hyper-partisanship, and part of it is the sensitivity of African-Americans. You've got older African-Americans now, Dale, who can remember the day when there were legal barriers and there were all sorts of games being played to keep African-Americans from registering to voting on Election Day. Now, that's not something we talk about that's 100 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
There are older African-Americans that have literally lived in that day. They've seen it, and that perhaps makes them more sensitive, that if we walked in their shoes, we would have that level of sensitivity about any constraints on voting. But I think this idea that we're going to disenfranchise large numbers of African Americans or any other minority if we require a pictured ID is just absurd.
Yeah, it seems a bit ridiculous, but it seems to be that's what they're hanging on to. Archer Davis, should any weight be given to what Archer Davis says, where he says, I've seen it, I've listened to people brag about it, and I've been asked to pay for it? Well, when all this is going on, he was a Democrat, so he wasn't saying anything about it. Well, should he be given any weight here on that?
Well, yeah, he should be given some credibility. I mean, he's a former member of Congress and so forth. But we also got to remember he's trying to
become a Republican.
I sense he's trying to remake himself as an R or as an African-American conservative of sorts. And, you know, after his debacle of a gubernatorial campaign and so forth. And we have to factor that into our thinking when we... when we hear the former congressman.
Well, the former congressman, this was 2011, by the way. I went and found this piece when I was writing my piece. Do you believe him? I mean, just personally, do you believe what he has to say, or do you think that there is sort of an idea that this is just sour grapes on his behalf? Where do you come down on that?
I don't know, but I have heard enough from over the years from both candidates and county officials and so forth I do think when you get into certain areas of the state, there has been a real problem with the absentee ballot. I keep coming back to that, but folks, in Alabama, if we're really going to hit the, if we're really going to deal with the key problem in Alabama, I think it's been the abuse of the absentee ballots in Alabama.
Well, I've got it posted up on our website, theattackmachine.com. Remember this. If you say there's no such thing as voter fraud, just go listen to Mo Brooks blow that silly notion to smithereens. We'll continue more with Dr. Jess Brown throughout the morning. Stay tuned. Live, local, News Talk, 770 AM, 92.5 FM, WVNN. Depend on it. News Talk, 770 AM, 92.5 FM, WVNN, News Time, 8:23 here on your Thursday morning. Thrilled to have Dr. Jess Brown here in the studio with us as he joins us every single Thursday. We always appreciate him being here. Dr. Brown, how you doing?
I'm doing fine, Dale.
Gun laws in Alabama have always been a hot thing. Everyone races to have the best. Everyone races to have their name on it sometimes. Beeson's ran into a roadblock. Maybe it had a lot to do with maybe Beeson is a tainted brand. I don't know if you agree with that or not.
And well, there could be a little bit of that, but I also would not underestimate the power of the Alabama Sheriff's Association either.
Okay, but in the state of Georgia, we saw a pretty interesting thing happen yesterday. The governor signed a law that allows carrying in bars, carrying in churches, if they'll allow it. Some of the schools can allow now for folks to carry. This is a step way further than Alabama has gone. So I guess my question to you in this short segment we have, will there be a rush from Alabama lawmakers to be next? Will there be a rush to be the guy who slaps your name on the bill that says, let's do it here?
I feel certain that Republican politicians in deep red states, Alabama being one of them, will continue to attempt to appease a certain segment of the conservative base in America, and you do that by appealing to Second Amendment interests and values. And there's no doubt in my mind that the next session of the legislature and the session after that and the session after that, we will have some kind of gun legislation introduced on the grounds that the national government is coming over the hill to take our weapons.
Let me back up here just a second and respond to some of that. Yeah. I don't think the fear is that the national government is coming to take your guns away.
That's what I hear.
Well, that's not my fear.
That President Obama and the national government's coming to take your guns.
I think a lot of the fear seems to be based on the fact, or not fear, but a lot of this seems to be based on the fact that we are creating these gun-free, this is the argument some of them were making, that we're creating these gun-free zones here where people feel like they're not safe. And whether or not you agree with that argument or not, I hear that a lot more than I hear, they're going to take your guns, because I agree, they're not going to take your guns. They can't. They may want to. But they can't at this point.
That's right. Good luck. I have not read the Georgia statute, but something tells me if I take a careful look at the Georgia statute, it doesn't go as far as allowing permitted gun owners to take these firearms as many places as the superficial press coverage suggests they do. I fail to believe that if you get a permit for a firearm in the state of Georgia, you're just going to be able to walk into a courthouse, walk into a public school, walk into a church. Something tells me that if we go and look at the language of the statute, we're going to find some constraints on that. That you can take it into the church if the governing board of the church permits you to. You can take it to the courthouse unless the courthouse security doesn't want guns in their courthouse.
Mm-hmm.
And then finally, you look at the something. I would guess that when you go through this statute, it may be a largely a symbolic gesture, and that it's sort of legislative Swiss cheese. You got my drift here?
Yeah, no,
yeah, it's got all sorts of holes in it. But somebody needed to look pro-gun, and so, you know, it's just a lot about. Sometimes politicians pass all sorts of symbolic legislation in order to attempt to appease a group and get the kind of press coverage we've seen on this bill. And even when symbolic, even when legislation that would have a minimal impact is introduced, you get the interest groups on both sides of the issue. They have an incentive not to call it symbolic.
Because you'll have people screaming, "Oh my God, there's going to be guns everywhere." And
that's Republican, right.
And on the right, they can say, "We won."
Because think about what the leadership and the activists in an interest group want. They want to keep their members and they want to add new members. Okay? And you don't do that by having a rational, mellow discussion of the issue. No. Say, man, if this bill passes, civilization comes to an end in Georgia. Or if it doesn't pass, there's going to be tyranny in Georgia. And of course, you get the over-the-top arguments both ways. But I would guess that if we had a copy of the Georgia statute, it doesn't go anywhere near as
you're saying it's overblown.
Yeah, I think the press coverage and the press. Let's take the press, Mr. Jackson. Which makes the better story today? The story that's where you tell a half-truth, but it has emotional fervor to it, or where there's a thorough elaboration of all the... Yeah. I mean, you know, come on. Melodrama sales.
I showed you earlier, Dr. Brown, remember this. I showed you earlier the story about BRAC that I tried to get Mo Brooks to talk about. Had one comment on
it.
But an article written that made... has nothing to do with anything that said the following: if Alabama and Auburn play today, Auburn would still win. 450 something comments.
That's right.
So if you're at AL.com and you're reading that, guess what do you do more of?
Melodrama sales.
Melodramatic football story.
Yeah.
Hey, real quick before we take our next time out, Georgia also made the news this week over their Confederate flag plates. What's your take on this? Is this some people say it's offensive. It was denied in one state because it was offensive. I want to say Texas. I may be wrong. Or some other state. In Georgia, they've expanded it. It went from a little decal to the whole plate. People are upset about this. Is there any reason for anyone to be mad about this? 40 seconds.
Well, Dale, the Confederate flag is... like beauty, it's in the eyes, you know, how much you get or don't get, it's in the eyes of the beholder. And people, particularly African Americans, have seen the Confederate flag used in the last 50 years as a symbol of segregation. But to certain other Southerners, it reflects something different, a 19th century cause that they still claim they believe in.
There we go. All right, Dr. Jess Brown, thank you very much. We appreciate that. Stay here. We'll be back more with Dr. Jess Brown. I always try to promote you to something bigger and better. Stay tuned. Dr. Jess Brown, Athens State University. It's WVNN.
The power of God has freed us.
It's live. It's local. It's the Dale Jackson Show on News Talk 770 AM, 92.5 FM, WVNN, WVNN.com, and on your smartphone on iHeartRadio.
News Talk 770 AM, 92.5 FM, WVNN, News Time 8:38. You're on your Thursday morning. Dr. Jess Brown in the studio with us. We always appreciate him taking the time to talk to us. What do you take about this affirmative action case out of Michigan? You're in higher ed. It's a political story somewhat, but it's more or less an affirmative action, a race story. There's been a couple of stories. I don't know how close you've been following what's been going on in California, where they were considering a piece of legislation that would have limited the number of Asians that are getting into school because the Asians are taking over the higher ed system. Four times their population are showing up in the school. So there's a whole bunch of different angles here. Is the affirmative action debate, I'm not going to say the debate, excuse me, is the affirmative action as an effective policy, is that dead? Or is it on its deathbed? Is it getting ready to die?
I think this Schulte decision of the other day is the most important decision of the Supreme Court on affirmative action since the Bakke decision in 1978.
Which said what?
That affirmative action was essentially permitted by the 14th Amendment, that racial preferences and perhaps other form of preferences would be permitted by to be done by universities because the university had something of a First Amendment right to pursue diversity in terms of its employees, diversity in terms of its student body. But I'm telling you, Justice Kennedy's opinion, and he's got six votes to include one Clinton appointee.
Mm-hmm.
I read the synopsis and then flipped over and read the, what I think's the critical section of the Kennedy opinion, and I believe Justice Kennedy has essentially, I think he's put the death nail in affirmative action in higher education in many states, because effectively what he's doing is he's punting this issue back to states.
Saying if you want to end it, you can. If you want to keep it going, you can.
That's right. That the 14th Amendment's Equal Protection Clause allows a state, that if the state wants to opt and say, okay, we're gonna allow our state universities to engage in some degree of the use of race in achieving a diverse student body, that might be permitted. But even there, Justice Kennedy says, I'm gonna kind of watch you real carefully as to how important that race factor is in your admissions policies and employment policies and so forth. But if a state, as Michigan did by referendum, if a state chooses to say our public schools and institutions of higher learning simply may not consider race, period, in its contracting, in its employment, in its admission of students and so forth, that the 14th Amendment does not prohibit a state from essentially banning affirmative action as we have known it for most of the last generation.
If you're a state's rights person, you like this ruling.
Oh, if I'm a member of the Alabama legislature, and I'm particularly if I'm a Republican member, I'm going to get me a copy of that Michigan amendment in their state constitution, and I'm going to introduce it verbatim in Alabama.
It's already been fought.
Because
been fought and won, right?
That's right, because if you adopt their law verbatim, I don't see how anybody would have a credible legal challenge.
And you know, it would also set up a pretty big fight there in the legislature, though, as it was getting ready to get passed. There would be a big fight over that particular piece of legislation.
Well, you know, you keep in mind, though, about the nature of the legislative fight in Montgomery is because if the Republicans maintain their supermajority in both chambers, as we've seen this quadrennium, some of those fights can go on for maybe an hour or two, but if leadership really wants to shut them down, the votes are there and the debate ends and a vote is taken.
So what's Alabama's admissions process in the state of Alabama? Is it up to the individual school systems? Do you see?
Yeah. As far as I know, there is no statewide mandate of any sort. Each institution and its board of trustees can do as it pleases. Please keep in mind, though, that the Kennedy ruling, the Kennedy ruling in the Michigan case does not prevent a federal district judge or a federal court from ordering a race-sensitive remedy at a school where the judge finds that at that particular school there's been a history and a pattern and a practice of racial segregation. But I would imagine in Alabama's institutions of higher learning today, you'd have a tough time. I mean, we've pretty much litigated those matters at our respective institutions. Remedies were ordered in the past by federal district judges, and our institutions of higher learning have pretty much complied with those remedies. Complied with those court orders and instituted those remedies. So I think you're not out on a limb to say that essentially what the six-member majority did on Tuesday in Washington is the Supreme Court has effectively put the nails in the coffin of affirmative action in higher education, generally as we've known it for the last generation.
What do you take from what happened or almost happened in California here recently? I don't know how closely you were following this, but in California they had a measure come up before the legislature passed one of the chambers, didn't pass the other, that basically would limit the number of a certain minority. They felt that the Asians were essentially taking over their higher ed system. They have universities that were majority Asian in California, and they wanted to address this. Now, eventually it failed, but only because the Asian American community, I guess, in that state, like, started going crazy, and they were like, "What are you doing? You're going to punish our kids for placing a higher value on education." What do you think of something like that?
I,
and obviously, so you're not running into that in Alabama. I doubt you have too many Asian kids in your class, or not too many, but more Asian kids than anyone else in your class. But in California, where the population shifts that way, where it's more Latinos got into college in the state of California than white people, saw that study yesterday, even though, you know, they're not a majority per se yet. What do you take from that information?
I think any policy that explicitly says we're going to guarantee somebody admission because of their race, or we're going to deny them admission because of their race, is a policy that, with the current federal courts, that policy, it'll be unconstitutional soon after the ink dries.
It's pretty interesting, though, to see a state like California consider something of this measure. What, I mean, we consider it to be a more liberal state. We'll be told they are out there in lefty land doing all sorts of liberal things, and then when it comes to college admissions, it appears they sort of almost went to George Wallace style. I mean, you want to talk about, I don't know what you would call it. I mean, I don't have a clever Jim Crow name for it. Jim Kwan, I guess we would call it that. But, I mean, it's weird to see that come out of a state like California, right?
Well, it's where the race politics gets entangled with the economics and the economic status. The truth is Asian Americans are a minority in an ethnic or racial sense, but they are also in a certain sense, the most economically productive subset of the races and ethnicities in America. You talk about California. I urge you, I have done this in recent years, I urge you to go to Harvard and MIT and walk around those campuses and see if you think the Asians that are there are, you know, simply their proportion of the population of the United States or their proportion of the population of Massachusetts. It's the truth is they do exceedingly well in the math and science area. They really do. They set the bar. That's the reality.
And they shouldn't necessarily be punished for
and
that.
And they certainly shouldn't be, no. And I don't think a federal judge would allow them to be punished for that. So even if California attempted to put a cap, this goes back to the stuff we had in the late 19th and early 20th century. You could find institutions that would put caps on how many Jewish students they would admit.
Really?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. You had institutions because of the religious groups, the Jewish subset, And there's a deep, rich tradition of intellectualism in the Jewish community, and they had a disproportionate number that would qualify for scholarships and for admission to the prestigious institutions of America. And you actually had some institutions that tried to cap the number of the Jewish admittees to their schools.
So you could use it as a factor, but you cannot use it as the sole factor.
That's right. In pursuing a diverse student body, the Supreme Court seems to say, well, you could look at the race of an individual if race is one of many, 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 many factors you're looking at, and that the way you actually apply the formula for diversity doesn't make race, that one race factor, the be-all and end-all. That it can be part of a complex formula for determining being socially disadvantaged, but it cannot be the factor any longer.
And lastly, before we take a call here, gay marriage. What does this say about gay marriage? Some say a lot, some say nothing. What do you say, Dr. Jess Brown? Does this kick back to the states and give them an opportunity to revisit the issues of gay marriage?
While this court is very, very... It seems to have stated its will both last year in the Texas case and this year in the Michigan case on affirmative action. I think on gay marriage, two of those six votes, Breyer and Kennedy, you're going to lose. And if I had to guess today, I would say that a complete state ban on gay marriage is just a matter of time before that's going down the tubes. I think the Supreme Court is going to use the 14th Amendment, if not the full faith and credit clause, perhaps both of them, and undo these state bans on gay marriages.
Well,
you can view that as good public policy or bad public policy. I'm just trying
to... Sounds like politics more so than consistency on the ruling, doesn't it?
No.
So what's going to happen? If gay marriage comes before, then what do they do?
If I had to guess today, I think it'll be a 5-4, maybe even a 6-3 ruling. A state that completely bans gay marriage is operating in violation of the 14th Amendment's Equal Protection Clause.
Very interesting. Okay, that's what he thinks is going to happen. Much of what I read said the same thing, but they said the door was opened and allowed that potentially this might play a role in that. Okay, let's take one quick call here. Thomas Athens, you're on with Dr. Jess Brown. Go ahead, Thomas.
Good morning, gentlemen. You said about socially disadvantaged ethnic groups needing help, but the Asians, I mean, they're no smarter than anybody else, any other ethnic group, but seemingly they are disproportionately represented in higher education according to their population. Are they more socially advantaged somehow than other ethnic groups? Is there something about their culture that inculcates the desire to learn and achieve that other ethnic groups, including whites, don't have? I'd like to hear your comments on that.
If from anecdotal information, I would say as a matter of generality, sir, that may be correct.
Mm-hmm.
The Asian family structure and the sense of self-discipline in the Asian community, I'll tell you, I'm grossly generalizing here, but if you ask me to generalize, yeah, from what I see, some you can even go back to the late 19th century and look at Asians that came to this country, you know, on the West Coast and entered the country under absolutely the worst of circumstances. And some of them were still able to become very successful entrepreneurs, even with all sorts of legal barriers against them running laundries and so forth. They became, within a generation, very, very successful entrepreneurs. So I is it social? Is it genetic? The truth is that we can have those debates, but we don't know enough about the genetic code of the human species yet to have worked all that out. But the reality is that I'm just telling you, the Asians do well on in the academy, especially in those science and math and technical.
Yeah, it's
things.
Funny you mentioned the rules against them being able to set up laundries and stuff like that. They actually tried to do something like that a few years ago in D.C. Still to this day. Mm-hmm. Marion Barry, one of the city council members there, said there are too many of them coming into this community. We got to stop them. They try to do the same thing.
Yeah.
There.
You can go around the globe, and in almost every culture, if you want to see really some deep-seated resentment, it is when you have one minority group that sees itself as behind the eight ball economically, and then another minority group comes on the scene and starts to be seen as very, very successful.
We come back, we'll talk about this. Good minorities versus bad minorities. And I think we're about to see a shift here, and we'll see what Dr. Brown thinks about that as well. Stay tuned. More coming up. It's the Dale Jackson Show, live and local, News Talk, 770 AM, 92.5 FM, WVNN. Depend on it. News Talk, 770 AM, 92.5 FM, WVNN, News Time, 8:56 here on your Thursday morning. We're going to table that conversation we were just having. I want to move on to something else here real quick. Locally, Madison County Commission voted yesterday, Dr. Brown, I don't know if you saw this, to table most of their cash business. Bob Harrison, surprise, was the lone dissenting voice saying we should continue doing a cash business. Now, we all know about former Commissioner Craig's issues, where he is now in trouble. I believe he got indicted over this, over the issue of cash being put in secret bank accounts and used, etc. There's a bunch of different counts. Bob Harrison, I brought attention to a few things he's been doing with cash over there. He wanted to keep the cash business going. What does that say to you? Does it say anything to you about what he's doing over there, or is it just him playing to his constituents?
Well, I don't really know. I don't know what his motivations would have been on that particular issue. I am, as a taxpayer, I'm kind of glad they stopped the cash transactions. I think any time we can, we should minimize the flow of cash when doing the government's business. Ought to have need a record, need a paper trail that's better than that cash transaction typically can provide. And I don't have a problem with what the commission did.
Now, when the commission, when this came before them, one of the things Dale Strong wanted to do was to do away with it altogether, do away with the gravel stuff altogether, do away with the private business stuff, or doing away, rather, with conducting operations that compete with private business altogether. We heard Congressman Mo Brooks talk about that, too. There's no reason they should be delivering gravel in Congressman Brooks's and, obviously, Commissioner Strong's opinion. What's your take on that? Will they ever eventually do away with this, or does something else have to happen?
What really will bring a halt to it is if, they have another scandal or two, The voter reaction will be such that they'll just want it all stopped. But I can assure you that over the years across Alabama, commissioners have found it to be politically beneficial to help Aunt Maud and Uncle Joe with their driveway on occasion.
A lot of them wanted to get away with it or do away with it, but they decided not to. So that business still goes on. They just won't be able to take cash anymore unless, of course, they do. And then we'll have to continue following that story. We're not done with it, but we're going to continue to try to figure out what's going on with Bob Harrison, that county commissioner. Stay tuned. Dr. Jess Brown, thanks for being here. We'll talk
to
you soon.
Glad to be here, Dale.
It's Dale Jackson Show, WVNN.
The power of God has freed us.